welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. That debt is fraud. And I want to make sure I remind you that Sean's not with us today. Or if we get him to join with us, that'd be great. We ended up having some internet problems, but let's not worry about our problems. Let's save everybody's problem. Now, everybody's problem can get on the right path if we start supporting Jerry Winstrom and his campaign. I can't emphasize enough, and everything I'm saying is legitimate. This guy is going to be the champion. He's going to place context on what's in the Constitution and what regarding Missouri as well as the United States. Getting a person at the state level to become a champion for the Constitution is going to be huge. Now, Jerry is a hardcore constitutionalist and a Republican. Get out there and support him. He is actually a true Madisonian Republican. So he needs your love. He needs your help. With that, let me just bring Tammy back in. So welcome back, Tammy. And
thank you.
Just so that we are clear, we still have some reading to do with the Rhode Island ratification debates. Now, we're on the 14th Amendment, so let's go ahead and knock these out before we jump into the Federalist Papers. Go ahead. The 14th Amendment.
That the Congress shall not declare war without the concurrence of two-thirds of the senators and representatives present in each house.
Okay, so again, they're trying to hamstring. Now, in all honesty, on important matters like that, I'm okay with that. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Jefferson did to make sure that even on fundamental things in the Senate, when he became the president of the Senate, or I should say, the tie split, you know, the splitter, and again, the president of the Senate, he created the decorum. Today, the filibuster, all that type of stuff goes back to him. He was the one, because John Adams, for the two terms under Washington, really didn't do anything. But when Jefferson got in there, he helped organize and create a decorum. And so the filibuster and the requirement of 60 senators or whatever the threshold was of a percentage, which I think it's 6/10. I think maybe that's what it is, whatever is in the rule, because it is 60 senators today. So he created that little threshold of it being more than just a majority to ensure that there was more of a consensus instead of just a mob rule. Again, they were not fans of mob rule, popular vote. But currently, that's how it goes for declaring war. It's not a two-thirds. And so I'm in favor of improving things like that. I'm in favor of improving the veto challenge from the president. You've heard me say this. The president should have the ability to say, I am vetoing this because this law, this bill you're trying to pass, is a direct violation of the Constitution, and specifying exactly what and why. And in that particular case, then that bill could not be overturned with two-thirds of both houses of Congress. There's no way in heck that Congress should be allowed to violate the Constitution because they can get enough votes, period. There needs to be a level of accountability. And it would have been great to see the president even have the power to remove people out of the Senate, out of the House, for directly violating their oath of office. But, you know, that was a pipe dream, at least in my head. But nevertheless, let's go to the next one, 15.
15, that the words "without the consent of Congress" in the seventh clause in the ninth section of the first article of the Constitution be expunged.
Okay. Now, with those words, "without the consent of Congress" in the seventh clause of the ninth section, so let's go to the seventh clause of the ninth section. And let's see here. Okay. Well, hold on here. Without the consent of Congress, let me go up, up, up. No, go down. There's the article. Okay, interesting. I am not finding in Article 1, Section 9. So, the seventh clause in Article 1, Section 9, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury. I just don't see anywhere where without the consent of Congress. So help me out here. Are you familiar with what they're talking about? The seventh clause in the ninth section of the first article is the restrictions placed upon the states. And I'm not seeing any. I do see in Section 10 that there is a requirement without the consent of Congress. That's in the third subsection. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any tonnage. So I think they missed it. I think what they meant was the 10th section. Anyway, so interesting. Like, you know, I guess this was an administrative error. Let's go to the 16th one. Go ahead.
That no judge of the Supreme Court of the United States shall hold any other office under the United States or any of them, nor shall any officer appointed by Congress or by the President and Senate of the United States be permitted to hold any office under the appointment of any of the states.
Okay. All right, the 17th. Go ahead.
17th, as a traffic tending to establish or continue the slavery of any part of the human species is disgraceful to the cause of liberty and humanity, that Congress shall, as soon as may be, promote and establish such laws and regulations as may effectually prevent the importation of slaves of very description into the United States.
So, yeah, I'm not sure that they, you know, in reading some of these comments, I think that in some ways they were kind of oblivious because they were abjectly wrong on the seventh clause of the ninth section. And the war, I mean, I'm looking at some of these amendments, and that one right there specifically, there are hardcore, I'll just say, compromises that are unchangeable in the Constitution. And dealing with slavery, that was a hardcore, you know, they couldn't change those things. That Congress could not start regulating the importation of slaves or get involved at all regarding states' rights. That slavery was a state issue, that the secret plan, but the real design of what they put in place would slowly eradicate slavery. And the whole Missouri Compromise proved that. But it just seemed like, okay, so they're taking shots here that I'm going, are they familiar with some of these things? Now, folks, just to be clear, Rhode Island was not involved in the convention. They've not been involved much at all in the Union other than don't bother us, we don't want to have anything to do with you. And now that they have to come in, they're trying to get, you know, a lot of the concessions that they had under the Articles of Confederation when government was impotent and inept. Anyway, let's go to the next one, 18.
That the state legislatures have power to recall when they think it expedient their federal senators and to send others in their stead. That would be nice.
Okay, so that is without saying that the state senators can be recalled out of the Senate. They can be. The recalling, but that would be a state matter. That wouldn't be a U.S. Constitution matter.
That's true, yeah.
Okay. All right, so the next one, 19.
that Congress have power to establish a uniform rule of inhabitancy or settlement of the poor of the different states throughout the United States.
Okay. They do have the power over the naturalization, what it takes to become a U.S. citizen. But to ask them to mingle and meddle in the affairs of the migrants going into states and you know, who can live in states and so forth, is crossing the line. The federal government was not to have any ability to dictate to the states, you know, what they were going to, how they were going to manage people living within their state. The only thing that they did was, or had the authority to do, was to set the standard of what it would take for the state to admit citizens into the union. That's why they have they have the power and responsibility of establishing a uniform rule of naturalization. Period. Okay? So, 20. Go ahead.
Yeah. That Congress erect no company with exclusive advantages of commerce.
That was brought up in the convention. And again, this goes to the debate itself to say, if it's not delegated, they can't do it. So they seem to be striking at things that aren't within the Constitution. They want to make sure they can't do it. But Madison was the one during the debates on the bank that Congress had no authority. It came up in the convention whether they should be allowed to create a corporation. And it was rejected that they could not create, which is why that power was never enumerated. And the fact of creating that bank was literally violating or basically assuming powers not delegated, as Madison stated. So the 21st one, last one.
That when two members shall move or call for the ayes and nays on a question, they shall be entered on the journals of the houses respectively. It's a roll call?
It kind of, but for the most part, when we look at the House of Representatives, they did a pretty decent job in maintaining and managing the journals of the House of the Representatives. The Senate kept a journal, but it was more of a summary journal for the first several years until they finally opened up their books. So that wraps up Rhode Island. Now what we're going to do, and I got to be fair here, folks, because what we're looking at with the Federalist Papers is we're looking at the last 8 Federalist Papers, which means, and in my academic article, this is Appendix 8. These are the 8 mysterious Federalist Papers that Hamilton created. Now, the information I get from where these came from is literally from the Constitution Society, where John Rowland was able to do a little more research to find out when Hamilton actually wrote this Federalist paper. Supposedly, these were never, and as a matter of fact, there's no record of them being published by the Library of Congress. So the question is, were they published or not? And actually, does it really matter? Do you get to describe a contract after the contract's been accepted? Especially when those explanations of the contract were never put before the parties, where the parties would have input or the ability to reject the compact with this new level of information. In other words, this is sneaking under the wire, under the door, parameters being granted to the federal courts that would have shocked the states. There's no doubt in my mind. So what we want to do at this point is kind of read this a little bit at a time. We're starting off with the 78th Federalist Paper. And so now, Hamilton uses the term, we proceed now, we, like he's got an army, you know, helping him with these Federalist Papers. And it's just him and his dark little dank closet with a candle so nobody knows what he's doing. Now proceed.
Yeah, you said he created them. You mean it was just him and that's it?
These last papers, these last eight papers were done by his hand and his hand alone. Nobody knew what he was doing. And so...
Okay.
And so when these got adjoined, I think he just tucked them in at the end and sent them out, and nobody questioned it. This is why I say, how come nobody has ever called him out on this? I mean, clearly we're looking at the date. The 14th of June is when New Hampshire was basically going into rubber stamp. That was the beginning of their convention, and there's no doubt because Hamilton was actually, and we're going to provide these facts to you. Hamilton was asking Madison, hey, let me know as soon as possible if Virginia's going to ratify, because if they do, that's when I'm going to start writing these secret articles that nobody's going to know about. He wasn't going to say that, but that was his ulterior motive of trying to get as much advance notice as he possibly could to start doing these secret papers during and right before the going into the New York ratification debates. This is why we're going to read, after reading these, we're going to read everything that Hamilton says in the ratification debates. There's only like 13 times, 14 times when Hamilton gets up and says anything. And so what does he say? While he's writing these comments regarding the judiciary, does he provide any of this information that the judiciary is going to be able to do these things? Of course not. This is all hidden. Go ahead and let's start with, you know, because, you know, I think he's telling a story. And what he's doing is he's literally using a lot of, artistic license, as well as dubious designs in what he's weaving in these Federalist Papers. So go ahead with the first paragraph in Unfolding the Defects.
In Unfolding the Defects of the Existing Confederation, the Utility and Necessity of a Federal... judicature?
Yeah, it's the same thing, as a judiciary. Go ahead.
Okay. Have been clearly pointed out, it is the less necessary to recapitulate the considerations that are urged, as the propriety of the institution in the abstract is not disputed. The only questions which have been raised being relative to the manner of constituting it and to his extent. These points, therefore, our observations shall be confined.
So he's kind of giving an announcement of how we're going to, wink, wink, him, is going to kind of answer some questions. But if there were questions, then why didn't this get brought up prior? We're talking about the judiciary. Why weren't questions answered when Madison was still around and involved? They had time.
Who's the we that we're supposed to assume is the we?
This is really just him. But everybody's...
I know it is, but who does he want us to assume the we is?
Well, whoever was behind Publius, and it became public knowledge that John Jay, James Madison, and him. But by this point in time... Nobody's looking at these Federalist Papers like Madison wasn't there. Everybody's looking at this like Madison was there. Madison was still a part of this. I'm not sure Madison ever read these. Go ahead.
Wow.
The next one.
The manner of constituting it seems to embrace these several objects. First, the mode of appointing the judges. Second, the tenure by which they are to hold their places. Third, the partition of the judiciary authority between the different courts and their relations to each other.
Okay, so he's talking about diving into the appointment part, appointing the judges, and the tenure, and then diving into this division or the separation of the judiciary authority between the different courts, between the federal, the Supreme Court, and the district courts, which are the, you know, the ancillary courts of federal, and then the state courts, not county courts, just going down to state, and that's it. So go ahead first.
First, as to the mode of appointing the judges, this is the same with that of appointing the officers of the union in general, and it has been so fully discussed in the two last numbers that nothing can be said here which would not be useless repetition. Second, as to the tenure by which the judges are to hold their places, this chiefly concerns their duration in office, the provisions for their support, and precautions for their responsibility.
So he quickly covers one already, right? And now he's jumping into the tenure, because by the very end here, he's saying, as to the tenure, which is the second issue that he was going to cover. So he barely said one sentence on the mode of appointing the judges. Well, we're not going to really cover that because we kind of have covered this already. So why even list? We're going to get into the details of it. He should have said that line up top and then said, what we are going to talk about is maybe the tenure, but maybe he's going to gloss over that too. Maybe he's going to gloss over everything and not actually stick to this little agenda he's created at the beginning. Let's find out. Go ahead. What's that? The next one.
According to the plan of the convention, all judges who may be appointed by the United States are to hold their offices during good behavior, which is conformable to the most approved of the state constitution and among the rest to that of this state. Its propriety, having been drawn into question by the adversaries of the plan, is no light symptom of the rage for objection which disorders their imaginations and judgments. The standard of good behavior for the continuance in office of the judicial magistracy is certainly one of the most valuable of the modern improvements in the practice of government. In a monarchy, it is an excellent barrier to the despotism of the prince. In a republic, it is no less excellent barrier to the encroachments and oppressions of the representative body. And it is best expedient which can be devised in any government to secure steady, upright, and impartial administration of the laws.
Okay, so halfway through, he basically elevates the judiciary into a magistracy. Now, the magistracy is a term of England. And the term magistracy means that somebody has the power to both make law, to take away law, decision, you know, a magistrate under the monarchical, because he even brings this up, in the monarchy, it is excellent behavior, it is an excellent barrier to the despotism of the prince, giving this extra power to the judiciary. I'm here to tell you, folks, that we got rid of the magistrate, that concept. The magistrate was divided in our branches of government, where the legislative authority was granted to the legislature. The executive authority was granted to the executive and the judiciary. The lesser was strictly, in other words, deciding the controversies of those things that they have, the, you know, within their realm of jurisdiction, they decided the controversies. That's it. They didn't have unlimited jurisdiction. So the point, I think, that is kind of interesting, how he's setting this tone. He's making it seem like this legal system is akin to the monarchical magistrate, and i.e. their judiciary. Go ahead. The next one.
We got about 21 seconds left.
Oh, we do. We have 21 seconds before we go into break. So, with that, I think that there's going to be some meaty stuff coming up, but I think this one really sets, definitely towards the end of this, where there's some stuff that really will jump out. But he's setting the stage, and there's definitely a sleight of hand when you don't want to get into hard details. And what he's not doing is he's not really helping you understand the contrast between our limited and defined government and the judiciary's role in it to this revitalizing a strong judiciary as what was in the British monarchy long before Parliament even. That was where the power sat. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me go back to the framework of Britain at the time. When they went to common law, we're talking around somewhere around the 11th century, 1000s. And it wasn't until the 13th century where the Magna Carta was created. In so doing, when the Magna Carta was created, they shifted into a new form of government. The form of government that they shifted away from was the king himself, or the monarch, and the judges that the king would appoint for lifetime, almost like a mini royalty, to be able to have control over his kingdom, and to keep the rest of the monarchy and everybody else in check. Now, when we went into the Magna Carta, this is when the land barons demanded a representative government. And this is when Parliament was formed. Now, why would they not be happy with the judiciary and the king ruling them? Because they weren't being honored. Their rights and those types of things were being trampled on under this common law of Britain. So the creation of Parliament started forming after the Magna Carta. And they created this representative government. And the magistrate didn't, like, go away. They were still out there. But things started growing in government and so forth. And the biggest problem that the monarch had at that point in time after the Magna Carta was the land barons controlling the counties. So he had to, over the course of time, and this was a transitory through the monarchies, they had to elevate these monarchs to a point of what we'll call royalty, where they became counts. And the land that they controlled were named after them as counties. You know, the county of Duke or whatever, right? And so now that the king had raised the perception, because when you start lifting somebody to a stage of prominence, they become a little less enamored with doing the daily work and details of management, you know, because you're telling them that they're better than that. And so the king creates the sheriff, and the sheriff becomes the principal, you know, pawn for him in ruling the counties. Ergo, this separation of the counts and their control over that land when creating, you know, the Magna Carta and so forth. And next thing you know, the king has created or obtained more control. So, but government has grown. The monarchies have grown. The land barons have been injected. And now we have sheriffs being appointed by the king. So, and they still have the judges. Government never downsizes. If you've never noticed, it never downsizes. It's not just unique in America. It is the nature of government to continue to grow. So the king or the monarchs eventually made the next big shift 300 years later and breaking away from the Catholic Church, which was kind of keeping them under their thumbs anyway, and the fact that somebody wanted a divorce. So they went off and created their own monarchy, which took about 100 years to migrate away from Catholicism to the Episcopal Church. But the king himself, now the king himself has the dubious honor, because prior to that, the Roman Catholic Church was controlling the Archbishop of Canterbury and those, you know, the leaders of the religion in England. Now the king has pulled under his control the Archbishop of Canterbury, who now became basically the Pope for the Episcopal Church, the leader of the Episcopal Church, the religious leader, and the king gets to appoint him. And then the Archbishop of Canterbury, in kind, does exactly what the king wants in appointing who the king wants to replace him. So this manipulation and this management and this growth of control just keeps going. And we're talking, this is the 1500s. What ended up happening a century later, the 1680s, is the second revolution, or I should say the Glorious Revolution, where the people of Britain, instead of the land barons, the people of Britain said, we've got rights and you can't be doing these things. Because he was getting out of control. And that's where they got the Glorious Bill of Rights. Now, 100 years later, barely that, if not less, Blackstone started creating the Commentary on the Law. And at that point in time, they were already seeing shifts, where the king and the monarchs and Parliament were assuming more controls and powers. Now, they still allowed, and they still called in England, the judges magistrates. But when we looked at America, we've already seen how the magistrate was the legislative body. The magistrate was, you know, the governor. The magistrate was, you know, whoever was possessing the majority of the power. And at the time of the Constitution, in every state of the Union, the legislature was the residual mass of the sovereignty. They were the sovereigns. They were the magistrates. Whether they had a judiciary, some states didn't even have a judiciary. So I'm just helping everybody understand this concept of elevating and granting supreme power to a magistrate was not favorable and was not considered favorable, because our forefathers, the framers, didn't look at the judiciary as this great thing to invest power to. They were a necessary evil in basically administering justice for controversies and controversies alone. Don't let them have access to power. That's like making law and so forth. As a matter of fact, Newt Gingrich, way back when he was, I think when he was still in office, or when he was still relevant, did a really nice video on how the judiciary was a body in government that was not trusted and was basically confined from being able to do the things that it does today, and why the framers did that. So the point is, folks, that what Hamilton is setting in motion is he's trying to obviate this, you know, this gap, because eventually things change. People forget what was said 10 years ago. You know, life expectancy is what it is. The lack of having, you know, the printed word in everything, you know, people having, you know, this profound understanding, because when you read things over and over again, you get a profound understanding. Not everything was printed. I mean, they may have had certain records, but when the records aren't there, like, who read the Federalist Papers? The people of New York, not the people of every state. Who read the ratification debate of the state? The people of the state. So there wasn't this movement, and this is where I say, sorry for this long monologue, but I think it's worth setting the stage here, this is where I would say the failing of the framers, what they should have done was they should have consolidated the ratification debates themselves. They should have galvanized them, and they should have created a bibliography for them. They should have gone through and said, yes, you know, and they would have actually seen, they would have obtained a testimony, a conviction that the way these objects were explained in these different ratification debates was harmonious. There was no conflicts. Limited and defined. I mean, they were basically saying the same thing in different ways. So had they done this and created this, what we would call a Bible of the Constitution, you know, they would have been able to say, look, this is how this Constitution was defined, and this is how you move forward, period. You want to change these things, you have to use an amendment moving forward. But they didn't do that. They had a lot of faith and trust in each other. They had a lot of faith and trust in the character of these men at that time. And there were a lot of other really pressing things like this war with Britain that really wasn't over. All sorts of things kept them from doing what would have really made things very easy so that America wouldn't have slid into this trough, this slough, you know, this pigsty that it's in today. We wouldn't have gone through the Civil War. We wouldn't have gone through a lot of these problems had we done the right thing. So hindsight being 2020, you know, we're now reading and exposing some of these ideas that go, oh my gosh, wow, how is it that we got into this situation when we're reading the Constitution that the judiciary doesn't possess these powers? So this is how we're doing this. So let's go ahead and read into the next one, because what he just did, what Madison just did, was kind of created this nice attachment to the term, you know, magistrate, and this concept of our British heritage and how, you know, we have a British legal system when we don't. He's creating a facade. Go ahead with the next one. Thank you.
Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution. That's hilarious. Because it will be least in capacity to annoy or injure them.
Keep going. Thank you.
Oh, okay. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments.
Okay, so up top he's basically saying, with this really light, casual way, you would think that he would start aggrandizing at this point, but he's not. He's saying the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous. So don't look at them as your enemy to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be the least in capacity to annoy or injure them. He didn't want to connect the dots that interpreting the Constitution so that they could understand the law would be tantamount to changing the Constitution. He didn't want to connect those dots. All he's doing is saying, oh, look, these guys are safe. And then down towards the end, he says, it may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the execution of the executive arm, or even the efficacy of its judgments. How is it that they're making a ruling, the next thing you know, it becomes law? How did that happen? How did they obtain that level of power with Roe v. Wade? Next thing you know, abortion's legal.
Mm-hmm.
Were they dependent on the executive to say, hey, abortion's legal now? No. They have already usurped that power. They usurped that power a while ago. So, anyway, let's go ahead and read the next one.
The simple view of the matter suggests several important consequences. It proves incontestably that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power, that it can never attack with success either of the other two, and that all possible care is requisite to enable it to defend itself against their attacks. It equally proves that though individual oppression may now and then proceed from the courts of justice, the general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter. I mean, so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive. For I agree that there is no liberty if the power of the judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. And it proves, in the last place, that as liberty can have nothing to fear from the judiciary alone, but would have everything to fear from its union with either of the other departments, that as all the effects of such a union must ensue from a dependence of the former on the latter, notwithstanding a nominal and apparent separation, that as, from the natural feebleness of the judiciary, it is in continual jeopardy of being overpowered, awed, or influenced by its coordinate branches, and that as nothing can contribute so much to its firmness and independence as permanency in office, this quality may therefore be justly regarded as an indispensable ingredient in its constitution, and, in a great measure, as the citadel of the public justice and the public security.
Yeah, citadel. And so...
citadel.
Yeah, so what he said up front is it proves incontestably, that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three. Don't worry about that. You only need to worry when they join to the legislature or they join to the executive. In other words, this is what you want to watch for. In other words, if you've ever told somebody, you know, not to think of something, you know, what you just did was you've told them now that they're thinking, that's exactly what they're thinking. And so he's now set the stage for where people will be looking for this adjoining of the judiciary, because right now the judiciary stands alone. And right now the judiciary stands above all. Right? The judiciary is the one that chastises Trump. The judiciary is the one that chastises Congress. Oh, yeah. They never adjoined. So how did this happen? Because we were looking for them to adjoin, because that's how they would get dangerous. They were feeble, like it says here, incontestably, that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments. That they could only become great if they adjoined. So how is it that we have such a powerful judiciary without adjoining? Ah, the secret lies
in... because they rewrite the Constitution, so...
Right, so the secret really lies in these further details of these innate powers that exist that end up becoming the portals of the federal judiciary to assume more and more and more power. So, go ahead. Let's read the next one.
The complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. By a limited constitution, I understand one which contains certain specified exceptions to the legislative authority, such, for instance, as that it shall pass no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, and the like. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of courts of justice, whose duty it must be to declare all acts of contrary to the manifest tenor of the Constitution void. Without this, all the reservations of particular rights or privileges would amount to nothing.
Okay, so here we're looking at this idea that by a limited constitution, I understand one which contains certain specified exceptions to the legislative authority. Such, for instance, as to it shall pass no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, and the like. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of the courts. And yet it's the courts that have allowed ex post facto laws and bills of attainder and punishment to go forward, because they no longer hold that, and nobody stands up and says, this is an ex post facto law. We see this in states, and we see this going into federal courts, where the state has no authority over water rights. And the state has basically come in and said, if you own land, and you don't have a well on that land, but you were planning on putting a well, you can't. We now prohibit you to putting, you know, any type of well or being able to access groundwater from your property. What does that mean? That means that they now took the land that you purchased where you had the legal access to the water underneath it, and they now passed a law that says you no longer have access legally to that water. That in itself is an ex post facto law. And what does that mean? That means that the courts should actually say, hey, you can't do that. You can create the law, and then all property transfers that occur afterwards, if that property doesn't have a well, then whoever's buying it can't put a well on it. You have to grandfather those people who own the property, because what you've done is you've literally changed the legality and made something that was legal illegal for those property owners. In essence, that is hardcore an ex post facto law. So why is it the courts aren't standing up and protecting property rights? So in other words, he's saying that they're going to do the right thing here, but they've actually become the evil or a part of it, even in this essence. Okay, so the next one.
Some perplexity respecting the rights of the courts to pronounce legislative acts void because contrary to the Constitution has arisen from an imagination that the doctrine would imply a superiority of the judiciary to the legislative power. It is urged that the authority which can declare the acts of another void must necessarily be superior to the one whose acts may be declared void. As this doctrine is of great importance in all the American constitutions, a brief discussion of the ground on which it rests cannot be unacceptable.
Okay, so this is an interesting paragraph. Because he says that the courts to pronounce legislative acts void. He says, actually, some perplexing respecting the rights of the courts to pronounce legislative acts void, because contrary to the Constitution has risen from the imagination that that doctrine would imply a superiority of the judiciary to the legislative power. It is urged that the authority which can declare the acts of another void must necessarily be superior to the one whose acts may be declared void. As the doctrines of this great importance in all the American constitutions, a brief discussion on the ground on which it rests cannot be unacceptable. Keep going now.
There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised is void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal, and that the servant is above his master, that the representatives of the people are superior to the people themselves, that men acting by virtue of powers may do not only what their powers do not authorize, but what they forbid.
Okay, so this is a lot of great lip service regarding nullification and voiding a law. Here's the question. Did the Constitution grant the judiciary any negative power over the legislative laws, the legislature at all? Can they basically say that law is unconstitutional? Do they have that ability?
No.
No, they don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Right. And so he's basically saying, so this is the beginning of cracking open the box, where now the judiciary can supposedly come in and declare laws that are that are unconstitutional or not within the pursuant of the Constitution. They can declare them void. But the reality is this. Show me a law that is not in pursuant to the Constitution that the court has ever, ever declared void. Out of the federal legislature, what congressional law has Congress passed where the federal government has shut it down? I mean, it is so rare, but there's so many laws that are unconstitutional. If this was the case, they would be able to do it, but they don't have the authority, nor would they have the interest of maintaining constitutionality. The court has taken on the position of attacking the Constitution, whittling it down, and bending it so that it absorbs its authority and power. The court itself absorbs its authority and power. So they don't want to be held to this, that they have to do those things. This is why I tell people that nullification cannot be occurred without interposition. What he's talking about is the people themselves are superior, not the courts. The reality is it is our job to hold that legislature accountable, not the courts. But he's basically cracking it open and saying they can do this. And people look at that and think, well, that's good. You know, that everybody, if it's a bad law, we need somebody to say they can't do it. And so it's by getting you to accept a power not granted, but it's a good, noble thing that they do. You know, that they can do this. You know, this is, we want them to do this. We need them to do this. Because if not, who would do it? Because there's very rarely is somebody willing to cut their arm off to save their lives. Very rarely. That takes a real, you know, a real survivor. Most people are just afraid of amputating their arm, but it's happened, and we've seen that. But we've seen lots of people die because they were trapped and didn't do, you know, the dirty deed to basically to save themselves. They were just hoping that somebody would come get them. Anyway, so let's dive into the next part down as he's continuing this justification, because we're going to get to some meat a little bit down in this.
We're out of time.
Oh, shoot. Well, so we've covered to this point of the voiding. And so we will pick it up with the last paragraph on that page as we left off. And so with that, folks, this is going to take some time. We've gotten through two pages out of 33. So all things being equal, starting off in the next show, we should be able to cover a few more pages each show. But we're going to go through this line by line so you can see the deception and the wordiness that Hamilton uses. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.